Oh, how we laughed when Adam Wheeler said Maverick Vinales was going to be his surprise of the season. We all called him a madman. Adam, it turns out you're crazy like a silver fox, mate. That was a surprise to everyone except for you. And Mr. On Track Off Road, you were able to teach us all a very valuable lesson this weekend on the Paddock Pass podcast. Never underestimate Adam Wheeler. Never underestimate Maverick Vinales. Because, Adam, who was cheering more, you or Aprilia?
MV12, Steve, just never lose the faith. I perhaps got a little bit lucky with that one, but yeah, you're stepping on my moments of the weekend already.
Well, I think it's fair to say Maverick was always going to be mentioned in this one, but Neil Morrison, the voice of Moto2, and God knows how many articles through the course of a Grand Prix season for a variety of publications. But when you look at it, what was probably more humble pie for you to eat? Digia last year or Maverick now today?
Yeah, as if belittling Adam's predictions throughout the Qatar weekend, Steve. I actually was belittling them right before the sprint race even started. We have a Discord channel for our Patreon subscribers, and I was sort of jokingly saying, like, "Oh, you know what? Where's Maverick going to be at the after the first corner passes? Is it going to be 10th or is it going to be 12th?" And then he, proceeded to pull out one of the best performances of the last couple of years. So, it does show you that he still does have something left in him.
Yeah, and I'll tell you what, this was a weekend where we had obviously the surprise winner for Maverick, Jorge Martin, taking the championship lead, first career podium for Pedro Acosta. Adam, what's your grade for the weekend?
From the Grand Prix of Portugal, Steve, round two, I'm going to give it a six, only because one, we said we'd be a little bit tougher with the grades this year, and two, the Grand Prix was a bit of a snoozer for, until we got to the last three laps, and then it all kicked off and went a bit crazy. So I'll give it a six. Spectacular location, pretty busy in the end from the crowd. Weather could have been a bit better. So yeah, it was okay. I mean, not a disaster for a Grand Prix by any means, but yeah, we've probably seen better ones.
And Neil, what about you? What's your grade?
I'm going to go with the 7.5, Steve, because I think there was a danger that the Grand Prix was going to be a bit of a non-event come the end of the race. It certainly was going toward a sleepy conclusion, but then we had so much drama towards the end of it. What with Mark and Pecco, with Maverick crashing out, with Acosta's insane kind of rise through the field. There were lots of really big talking points to kind of get stuck into. So, I think that combined with a lovely weekend on the Algarve, it's not the worst place to spend a bit of time. We also had the good fortune of spending some time. Some of my family were in town, and some family friends were in town, and seeing the kind of the joy and excitement that accompanies people that don't go to MotoGP races very often. I think that kind of rubbed off on Ad and I a little bit, and even helped to soften the kind of cynical edges of our kind of usual, what was me, bah humbug kind of muttering. So, decent weekend all in all.
There was a time, Steve, on Sunday night. I think we had left the track just after 9 p.m., something like that. We were one of the last sort of to leave the media centre, so we went trying to find some food in Portimão, and we're in a restaurant. And Neil was still writing away. We had our colleague Sara Daniela on the other side of the table, and she was kind of thumbing through her phone. I think I put my head on the table at one point because it was the end of a long Grand Prix. So it just sort of everybody was feeling a bit knackered, and then like some of like Neil's family and friends came in and were saying, "What a fantastic Grand Prix! What a great race!" And like Neil says, it really does make you, appreciate sometimes that people are having a great time at MotoGP, and we're a bit stupid and we're a bit take things for granted. We should be enjoying ourselves more.
Yeah, I think it's one of those situations where it's always nice to remember that every time there is a race, it could be someone's first time there, their first time watching, and we were all captivated for whatever reason, and someone else would be in that same boat as well. So that is always important. Neil, you mentioned family as well. Obviously, we'd be amiss not to say that David isn't with us after the passing of his mother. So obviously, the thoughts from all of us and everyone listening and everyone that follows the podcast are with David and his family. Adam, we'll move on to the moments of the weekend. You've already sort of given a bit of a spoiler on what your moment is, but take it away. What's your moment?
It's hard to find exactly one moment from the whole Maverick Vinales experience, Steve, but I think just the time when he came out of the last corner and he obviously had a problem. He was telling us a little bit later on that he had been suffering with the clicking the RSGP into sort of fifth and sixth gear throughout the Grand Prix race distance. And then finally, the bike gave up the ghost along the main straight. He stuck his leg out. A lot of people around the time, I mean, you know, our colleagues, commentators, whatever, were trying to work out what was going on. I think there was even some debate about whether he had misjudged the amount of laps, you know, Aleix Espargaró style. And then sort of going into that first corner into the approach to turn two and getting spat off because the bike had gone into sort of second gear. And when, as soon as he opened the throttle, of course, it just spat him over the top. For me, it was just, you know, can you go from the highs of Saturday to those lows on Sunday? But, you know, it was just like the Maverick Viñales experience. You never really know what you're going to get these days. And, you know, it was quite staggering. And, of course, it allowed Pedro Acosta onto the podium. And, you know, it shook things up a little bit right at the death.
Yeah, and I think it's fitting, obviously, the roller coaster of Portimao, and it's Maverick that has that roller coaster of a weekend. Neil, what about you? What was your moment of the weekend?
At one point, I thought it was going to be Pedro Acosta's pass on Brad Binder. Fairly early in the MotoGP race on Sunday, down at turn one, he had obviously passed Jack Miller there in a kind of opportunistic fashion. But then the fact that he was able to do it on Binder was so impressive. And then the way that he pulled away from Binder, even more so. But my actual moment was when he caught up and passed Bagnaia. He tried to get passed on a few different occasions, but the way that he did it in such a kind of controlled, emphatic fashion into turn three looked as though he was a bit of a lunge, that he was going to run wide. But the fact that he managed to stick the gas cast on his nose at that particular point, hold his line, and yeah, just kind of shake off the reigning world champion as if it wasn't anything that kind of crazy or special, I thought was remarkable. And for the second race weekend in succession, it's been Acosta that's brought the excitement, brought the fun to MotoGP. Without him there, I think it would have been fairly drab. We just have to be thankful for it, because at the moment he's shaken up the establishment, and it's wonderful to watch.
It's a really cool collection of little stories. I mean, if you could pick three riders in the whole field that Pedro Acosta could overtake in his second Grand Prix, then Brad Binder, you know, the lead rider of the Pyro Mobility Group, the world champion himself on arguably the best bike, and then, you know, the best rider in the history of the sport. I mean, he'd done all three of them. It was really cool to see. So, you know, I think Neil's pretty much spot on there. What about you, Steve? What stood out for you? Because I know you were mired in World Superbike work, but I know you've had a chance to rewatch the Grand Prix.
It's a strange one, because when MotoGP and Superbikes clashes, you always have the GP on your phone or somewhere in the corner, so you're able to keep an eye on it. And my moment of the weekend was just because it happened pretty close in time-wise for both people. Like, Jonathan Rea had a big issue in the Superbike race one, where his inexperience with the Yamaha seemed to catch him out a little bit. So when Mark had his crash in the qualifying session, it was a little bit like that as well. He engaged the ride height device, and you were able to see that even though Mark is, as you said, Adam, the greatest rider we've ever seen, this was a mental mistake because he's having to relearn a whole new bike. And I think it was one of those things that gives you that timely reminder that Maverick's going to win races. You know, he's going to challenge for the championship. What he was doing this weekend on the GP23 shows that. But there is still that little bit that he needs to learn as well. And I think that's exciting for us, because we've seen Mark for 11 years in MotoGP on a Honda, and now we get to see that little bit of a transition for him as well. So for me, that was the moment, even though you could pick 10 other things that happened in the weekend that were much more significant than that crash.
Yeah, I think also as well, it shows, you know, that, okay, it's a motorcycle, and it's not news that these things are much more complicated to ride in terms of the manual jobs that the riders have to do. But I mean, Mark hasn't really commented on the difficulty of the basics, whereas Franco Morbidelli, who's in a completely different place, has very little time on sort of the Desmos Sedici. I mean, he was saying that he's still very much in a phase where he's trying to work out what button does, you know, which role. He was even commenting on, you know, what does he push to engage the pit lane limiter, the ride height devices, and coming from a Japanese bike to a Ducati, which is much more sort of, you know, complex in its construction and those aspects. I think we have to forgive these guys for some sort of basic mistakes like that.
Yeah, and it turns out that moment that you mentioned, Steve, was pretty pivotal. I think qualifying in Portimao, unless you're your name is Pedro Acosta, qualifying in Portimao was pretty pivotal. And I think Mark had showed all weekend up until qualifying that he had the potential to qualify on the front row. I think if he qualifies in the front row, then he's not going to have issues with his front tire pressure throughout the race. And I think he'll be fighting for the podium at the very least. We saw the difference that a good start would make to the race with Enea Bastianini in the sprint. His start device didn't engage in the sprint race. He got mired off the start back in sixth, was pretty much anonymous. Anonymous couldn't really do any moves, couldn't be aggressive going forward. And, you know, once Mark got stationed behind Pecco in the opening laps, a similar thing happened to him. So it was interesting to see Frankie Carchetti, his crew chief, write a tweet, I think, on Monday after the race, just saying, right, we've covered a lot of bases this weekend, but next objective is sort out qualifying because that is going to be pivotal.
Well, I have to say, Neil, you've made me feel a little bit better now for picking that as my moment and then instantly telling me that it was significant. So that's good considering how little I saw from the weekend. We've mentioned a few times the pod over the course of the last couple of months as well. KTM do a good job of making us feel good. They're supporting the podcast through the 2024 season as well. And over the last couple of months, we've also been teasing people about some of the new range of naked bikes for KTM in 2024. So the KTM Duke has been the reference for torque, power, and just sheer character over the course of the last three decades. And anyone who's been up close to the 790, the 890, or especially the 1290s has been able to see just how special these bikes are. But now customers are able to have a look at the even madder 1390 Super Duke R, as well as the Evo version of that. So check out KTM.com to be able to get all the latest news on these bikes and where you're able to take them for a test ride. We'll move on to our big questions from round two. So Adam, I'm going to come to you first off. Was it just a big pissing contest between Pecco Bagnaia and Marc Márquez down to turn five? Because neither wanted to give an inch. For me, it was a full-on race in the instant just because both riders were in just jail yard mentality. They weren't going to get beaten by the other.
Sorry, Steve. You're not allowed to sit on the fence on this podcast. You can't blame a racing incident. It has to be the fault of somebody.
Is this how we get back to Sepang 2015? Because someone did mention how we're going to bring it back to us. So we can do that, Ad.
We're barely 10 minutes into the podcast. You couldn't even last to the half an hour stage.
No, I've got no endurance whatsoever. I'm all about the sprint these days.
Well, I mean, you know, it's obviously quite some days after the race now, and it's been seen many times, and people have had their opinions on social media. You know, I just wonder if you start to go into the psychological process of it or the fallout from it, then, you know, what was going through Pecco's mind when he saw that gap, you know, to try and make a move on Marc Márquez? I mean, would he have done the same if it was, say, Luca Marini last year or Enea Bastianini? It's, I think you cannot ignore the fact that there was a big 93 and that kind of target. And, you know, Bagnaia must be aware that, you know, a rider of Marc Márquez's ability and capability, I mean, that is like a big hen wandering into the hen house, isn't it? He's somebody he's got to confront and possibly beat this year. So that must have something to do with the move. That said, the way I see it, I think Bagnaia had a gap. He had the position. Okay, he could have anticipated Mark tightening up on the line. But, you know, as much as it is tempting to say a racing incident, I just think Mark should maybe have, you know, been a little bit more aware that there's going to be another bike there on the inside and perhaps checked up a little bit.
Yeah, I think it's more you have to be worried about the big cock coming into the middle of the hen house. And that's Mark, because why would he do anything different? The reason why Toprak was the focus of all the attention in the World Superbike paddock last weekend as well was because he's the same as Mark. He's going to give you the option to concede the corner, but he's always going to put his bike there. Pecco wants to make a statement. I think you're right when you say that if it was Bezzecchi or Digia or Martin or pretty much anyone else, I think he probably would have looked at it and said, you know what, I'll just try and settle for these points. But Mark still has that fear factor. He's still Marc Márquez. He's Marc Márquez until he isn't. He's on that Ducati now. Everyone knows that of those 2023 bikes, which is worth remembering as well, were a pretty tricky bike at the start for a lot of riders last year, that Marc's instantly got himself where he's pretty competitive. But I think one of the biggest things for me, Neil, is how many times do we see mental errors from Pecco when he's under pressure? Because this was another one. We saw, obviously, in the sprint, he's comfortably out in front, makes a mistake. We go to Coda next. He did that last year. You know, this is a rider that's a double world champion, but I think everyone else kind of can see some chinks in the armor. I think if you're Jorge Martin, then you definitely think, you know what, I think I've got a real chance this year, just because Pecco is liable to make mistakes through the course of the year.
Yeah, he's such a strange rider, isn't he? Because he's, in certain occasions, he's so kind of mentally bulletproof in high-pressure situations. Like, he's withstood incredible pressure in very, very tense races when fighting for world championships. We've seen that in the past 2 years. But he does occasionally, when not feeling at his strongest, appear fallible and make mistakes. And I would disagree slightly with that. I mean, I think it's a racing incident. I think it's two guys going for the same piece of tarmac. Neither wants to give an inch. Obviously, Pecco does not want to be beaten by Mark in his second full race in Ducati. That would be awful for him and would probably be a surprise for him considering how strong his preseason was. But I think if you had to point the blame at someone, maybe it's Bagnaia, just because the gap was so tight. And obviously, you have to go for that gap, but you know that Mark is coming back in you. Like, you just know that for a fact. And we saw when Pedro Acosta passed Pecco down at turn three, he tried to get the drive up into turn four around his outside, but knowing that Acosta was going to be coming across, rolled the gas, let Acosta through, because it would have been a collision had he not done so. And I think it would have been the same. You know, we're talking about split second decisions here, but I think, knowing what Mark's like, you should maybe just be careful there. And it was interesting what he was saying after the race. He was struggling all race long in turn four and turn five. He said those are the two places where he was losing tenths of a second. So in a place where you have been at your weakest throughout the race to try and respond, it smacked a little bit of desperation for me. But I can completely understand why he did it. And I think the stewards took the right course of action by saying no penalty. Mark was obviously quite interesting afterwards, saying that if you're doing this for the lead on the final lap or the final couple of laps, then it's understandable. But if you're doing it for a difference of 2 points between fourth and fifth place, then it doesn't really make that much sense. Pot calling kettle black comes to mind with Mark saying that, for sure. But at the same time, I kind of see his point as well. And, you know, there were some pretty direct and straight to the point comments from Gigi Dolinha after the weekend in Ducati's official press release, where he was saying it's not an ideal situation. Both guys were on course to score solid points and they've come away with nothing. There's nothing more left to say, but it's a situation where Ducati are really going to have to try and manage this, because I think everyone that watches MotoGP is expecting this to be the first of several flashpoints between the pair, because they're both going to be fighting for the championship.
I mean, Bagnaia was fuming. I think more than anything, when he sat down to talk to us in the media debrief, of course, everybody wanted to know about the crash. You know, how did it happen or what was his point of view? But he said, no, first of all, I'm going to talk about my race. And he almost wanted to explain why he wasn't as competitive as we thought he would be. Of course, he did the double in Portimao last year. And then, you know, he was not really at the races. I mean, of course, there was the crash in the sprint as well. So it ended up being a very poor weekend for Bagnaia. And I think he was frustrated because he actually made a comment to the fact that he wanted to have more consistency this year. And already by the second round, he's been on the floor and, you know, put a zero on his scorecard. But I mean, if you compare Marc Marquez and Pecco for a minute, there really isn't any comparison. I mean, Marc's won, what, three races in 4 years? And since Aragon 21, I mean, Bagnaia's been a winning machine. I think I looked it up earlier, he's only finished off the podium twice. You know, one was in when he's finished a Grand Prix. That was in Argentina in 2023. And then, you know, when he took the championship in Valencia, I mean, he finished ninth and did what he had to do that day. I mean, his record is brutal, basically. So, you know, for him to kind of make that mistake and to take that risk, you know, like Neil says, it does make him a little bit more mysterious. I mean, what kind of strategy has he got here, or did he just lose the plot briefly?
Yeah, I think you're right. You can't compare them. One's a six-time world champion in the MotoGP class, and one's a two-time world champion as well. So you can use your numbers to paint a picture for both of them. But I think one of the things that's quite interesting for me, Neil, is Portimao. Obviously, we mentioned about the crash and qualifying for Mark. But what did you think of his actual performance level this weekend compared to what we had in Qatar? And obviously, we'll go to Coda and we'll expect that he's going to win in Texas.
Yeah, like I said previously, I think it was influenced by qualifying. Up until qualifying, I thought he was having an exceptional weekend, and he was looking very, very ominous with his speed right the way through practice. His sprint performance was excellent as well. Didn't have anything for Vinales, but came through, finished second in the sprint with a brilliant late overtaking move on Jorge Martin. And had it not been for the collision with Pecco, he would have come away with a fourth place, which would have been pretty good in the circumstances after a bad qualifying and having those issues with front tire pressure. So I think, generally speaking, it was a pretty positive weekend. We're obviously expecting more from Mark. I think a lot of people were expecting him to jump on the bike and go immediately fast, and maybe some people were thinking he was going to immediately smoke his rivals. I think he's doing a pretty solid job. Disappointing to have the big fat zero next to his name after Sunday's race. But from where he is in his kind of Ducati career, I think it's decent. And another thing, just briefly, I think it's good that it's been like this because it validates the level of MotoGP at the moment. If he had gotten on a Ducati and smoked everyone immediately, then we're thinking, oh, okay, everyone isn't really up to much when you compare them to Mark. But the likes of Martin, Bagnaia, Binder, when they have been racing at the front so far this year, they've shown that the level is exceptionally high, and it's not just a case of Mark jumping on the best bike and smoking them. He's going to have to really learn the ways of the Ducati and work for this.
Yeah, it's a great point now, and we're still in the formative stages of the championship. I just wondered, I mean, based on Qatar, we're all like, yep, this is Bagnaia's really to lose. But I just wondered now, considering the points and everything else, I mean, it's put Jorge Martin in a fantastic position. But if we had to choose between Bagnaia and Marquez, for you two guys, which rider would you plump for? Steve, you were looking at the odds. Who would you put your money on at the moment?
Well, it's an interesting one, just because what Neil said there about not smoking his rivals, he actually has. Because when you look at his form compared to the other GP23 riders, he's miles ahead of them, you know, Portimao especially. So it shows the level Mark's running at. But then we also saw that there's been a step made with the new bikes for this year as well. I think if you're laying anything down, I'm still betting on Jorge Martin. He's got a better bike underneath him, and he's the fastest rider in the world. And I'll take that speed any day of the week. I think especially because he's clearly learned a bit from last year. Even if it's only that 1% to make it where he avoids making some of the mistakes he made at the end of last year. I think Jorge Martin, for me, is such a good rider right now. He's blindingly quick for a single lap. And I think he can put together a run of results that I don't think I can see Pecco doing. I think if it's a straight up fight, I think Jorge can beat him.
Was the question not Marquez or Bagnaia, Steve?
Oh, sorry. I misheard you there. Marquez or Bagnaia. Pecco's on the GP24. I'll take Pecco.
Fair enough. I was actually, how do we feel about Jorge Martinez, MotoGP world champion?
I feel fantastic about it. I'll reference my previous mistake.
Well, Neil and I were talking a bit about this on the show that we recorded on Sunday from the press room in Portimao, because, you know, in the press conference, when Martin was asked about Pedro Acosta, you know, he was complimentary, but also very quick to remind us all that he also finished on the podium in his second race. And there's just this little chip on the shoulder that I think has something to do with, you know, this affects his popularity somewhat. I don't know. I don't see him as, I see him as an admired rider, but not a particularly sort of loved one, or followed. I think there'd probably be a much more goodwill towards, say, Mark or Pecco or even Bastianini winning the championship compared to Jorge. Just my feeling.
I'll just put the brakes on your comments there, Ad. We are just after round two of the season. There's still 19 runs to go. I think we're getting ahead of ourselves ever so slightly talking about Jorge as a possible world champion. But yeah, he's what we've seen so far early this year, you know, he's going to be in the mix, I think that's for sure.
I think for me, what I'd say is Martin, I love Martin, but I don't like him because he's not a likable character. But out on track, I think it's impossible not to respect him because of that speed.
Yeah, so
I think that's the kind of way I kind of look at it. But Adam, I think it's one of those ones that kind of teases up nicely as well about Pedro Acosta, because when we were doing some of our pre-season content, one of the things that we kind of talked a little bit about was how long is it going to take for Mark to win? And then we toyed with the idea of talking about how long it would take for Acosta to win. He's had that first podium. He's impressed everyone in the first two rounds. And you'd have to say, at this point, all bets are off for what Pedro could do. I know that a few riders were saying, you know what, he's already in title contention if he can do some of these things. A lot of that's just, let's put as much pressure on him as possible and see if he can survive the avalanche. But two rounds in, Neil, you had him for the overtake earlier on as your moment of the weekend. And like you said, you could pick multiple overtakes for that. He's got no fear, Ad.
Yeah, and I think you have to credit him for two things. One, the sheer ability to be able to do what he's doing with such little experience. I mean, we were mentioning earlier about riders just needing to work out the controls of motorcycles. And there is Acosta really sort of, you know, kind of dirt track style, sliding this thing into some complex turns and really making the whole machine work. But I think we also have to give some credit to KTM and, you know, the Pyrum Mobility Group for that gas-gas setting, because it is becoming a motorcycle that, you know, people can use and they can sort of bend to their will. It's not just like a Brad Binder bike. And maybe before you could level the accusation saying it was a Polo Spyro machine. But, you know, I mean, Acosta is doing things with the machine that not many riders have been able to do. And he's now the fifth rider to have made a podium finish with it since it's been in the championship, you know, at the beginning of 2017. I think that's significant. And, you know, all this talk about Acosta winning, I thought was a little far-fetched. But, you know, it just proves that what it needs is some freak incidents to happen to a couple of other people on the grid, and he's going to be in the running for it. And, you know, we were talking pre-Portuguese GP saying, you know, there's no way that Acosta is going to be as impressive as he was in Qatar because he just doesn't have the track time.
You said that, Ad. You said that. I'm not sure I did.
Well, I think you were nodding along, Neil. I'm pretty, you know, convinced of that one. But, you know, and that's sort of the sky's the limit now, isn't it?
Yeah, I agree with you 100% that... that I was thinking that the talk of maybe winning this year was a bit premature. I just thought it was such long odds when you think about MotoGP and what it's like nowadays, how difficult it is to get up to speed on the current MotoGP machinery. And it's just, yeah, it's quite remarkable what he's done. I rewatched back the race today, and it was quite funny when he was making those overtakes on Miller, Binder and Marquez at the start of the race. It was quite reminiscent of the start of the race in Qatar, where obviously he made that brilliant comeback from 10th up to 4th at one point and then burnt out his rear tire. Now, obviously the rear tire conservation wasn't such a big issue this weekend in Portugal, but the general consensus was, oh, this might not last for long, but it's thrilling while it's happening. And the consensus was he's just doing the same thing as he did 2 weeks ago, putting everything into these couple of overtakes to try and run with these guys and then to hell with the consequences for later in the race. But it showed you just what he had learned from one race weekend to the next, that he was able to continue that speed right up until the end to attack Bagnaia 4 or 5 laps from the checkered flag. It was quite remarkable. And I managed to catch up with his team owner, Hervé Poncharal, over the weekend, maybe with an interview we can run on the podcast next week or in the next couple of weeks. And Hervé was saying, yes, the kind of the talent is one thing. The talent is incredible. How he's able to put comments from his crew chief and his crew into effect in his riding the next time he goes out on the bike is the sign of genius. But what really stood out for Hervé is the work ethic and just the amount of effort and thought that Pedro was putting into it. He said 8:30 on Wednesday morning, Pedro was at the track in the box talking to his technicians. He said after the sprint race in Qatar, Sunday late morning, early afternoon, when most of the other riders are still at their hotels, hanging out in the swimming pool, you know, with the late start in Qatar, he was in the box rewatching the sprint race, looking at what Jorge Martin was doing up front with Paul Gravatt and his crew chief and some other crew members, just trying to study exactly what needed to be done to kind of get the best out of his package. So, there's a kind of a humbleness, I think, from him. And there's a real diligence, a hardworking ethic, which complements this brilliant talent that he has. So, I just loved the sort of tenacity of him in this race. It was remarkable. Just the kind of, I don't care who you are, I don't care what your reputation is. And some of the shapes that he was able to make on the bike, I mean, my jaw was pretty much hanging open for a lot of the race, thinking a crash is coming. and it never did quite come. So yeah, remarkable performance. I think we've really genuinely witnessed something quite special.
Yeah, I agree completely, Neil. And I think, you know, we spoke with Paul Trevathan after his debut in Qatar, and then it was, you know, I bumped into Paul again in the paddock, and we got some quotes from him for, you know, our Sunday show, if you want to go and check that out on SoundCloud or any other channels. And, you know, I just love the moment during the race, Steve, where we had the real top brass from the Pira Mobility Group, Mr. Pira himself, sitting there. And, you know, when it was a great bit of TV direction, actually, because as soon as Pedro, I think, passed Mark, you know, they cut straight towards, you know, like Pit Beirer, Hubert Trunkenpolt, Stefan Pira, Jens Heimbach, basically all the people that are pulling the levers for KTM in MotoGP. And you could almost see them thinking, get the contract ready. You know, get this kid in the office afterwards. We have to get him signed up. And for sure, he's putting zeros on his contract at the moment, isn't he? He's, you know, he's making his stock soar. And does that bode badly for the likes of perhaps Jack Miller? I mean, for 2025, we know that, you know, Brad Binder has a contract and he's going to be in orange. Does Pedro Acosta switch across? You know, these questions are going to become more and more valid the more that Acosta keeps performing like this.
Yeah, I think it's one of those ones as well, lad, where Pedro has obviously put himself into the position now where KTM have to make a change for next year. And that's what a rider's job is. It's to make the team and the manufacturer be motivated to put you in their factory seat. If you're KTM, you've seen enough in these two rounds to feel pretty good about making a change, which would obviously be for Jack Miller. And Binder and Acosta together, that's the dream for KTM. It's two riders they've brought through a long part of their career, particularly Acosta, right from the junior GP days. So it's very difficult to see how it isn't inevitable that that happens. But from Acosta's perspective, Neil, you talked about the work ethic. He still does all those figure of eights in the car park in Murcia every time he's at the track. He's out riding the whole time. That's just the way that he is. And, you know, it's always interesting that you see riders working really hard or being public about when they're working really hard, when they need to do the hard sell. Acosta's just always been like that. And I think that's what shows a lot of his character as well. And Pedro's a special talent. We knew it in junior GP from whenever he challenged for the championship there. He won the Red Bull Rookies the same year. And it was him against Izan Guevara for the Moto3 championship. And the two boys were really impressive that year. Guevara ended up winning the championship, but it was no surprise really when Acosta stepped up and did what he did in Moto3. I remember that year I had a bet on Guevara to win the championship in Moto3 as a rookie, just because the odds were so much better than what they were for Acosta. But if Acosta had been the long odds, I would have been putting my money on him as well, because they were that special coming through. And, you know, that talent just stands out from the outset. And even when you look at him in Moto2, the class that he didn't really enjoy, he was still fantastic in that. If it wasn't for his injuries, probably could have won the championship as a rookie as well.
Yeah, just very quickly, I think with some riders, they have a lot of success in the junior classes. They come up and they start believing they're the next big thing. Pedro has every right to think that, because he is the next big thing in MotoGP. But it seems, just from speaking to people in Tech 3, the way he treats the team, it doesn't give any indication that he has that sort of superstar element. He's humble. I think Hervé Poncharal told me within a few hours at the Valencia test, he already knew everyone's name in the garage and was talking to everyone, making jokes with everyone. Little things like that for a 19-year-old just show that he is something a bit different. Mark Marquez had that when he stepped up into the MotoGP class in 2013. Paul Trevathan said he's an old soul in the young body. And that, I think, is more than the riding talent. That is a thing which makes me think he's going to, that he could maybe win a race this year, which is a remarkable thing. Would be a remarkable thing.
Yeah, I think it's one of those things as well. We do see it where some riders take to MotoGP like a Dr. Water. Obviously now it's a bit different with the aero and the ride height and all those things. But when Fabio Quartararo, for instance, stepped up, he was instantly really impressive. Same obviously when you look at Mark and a few other riders in recent history. But let's move it on to one of the next big topics of conversation in the paddock. What do Factory Ducati do for next year, Adam? Because they've got a decision to make once again. Jorge Martin or Bastianini. Bastia with another pole position, his first as a factory rider this weekend. He's made a step forward coming into these first two rounds. do Ducati upset the apple cart with Pecco Bagnaia and bring in Jorge Martin, or do they risk losing Martin to another manufacturer? Let's say, for instance, Aprilia's just won the sprint. They won races with Aleix as well in the past. That's obviously going to be an appealing bike to have, and they would just leave a forklift full of money on Jorge Martin's doorstep, you think. So Ducati's got a big decision to make.
I think you could say that Bagnaia swallowed quite a bit of the budget. So maybe if one of the stipulations Martin has is that he wants equal billing or, you know, a much improved contract, then that could be a stumbling block. You know, if you're talking about form between Bastianini and Martin, then clearly it's Martin. He's won more. He's been in championship contention. If you're talking about potential, then I think the dispute is a little closer because, you know, Bastianini's response to being punted out of the action, you know, last year at Portimao was pretty impressive, Steve. Like you say, he had that pole position. He screwed up with the whole shot device in the sprint, as Neil mentioned. And then, you know, his Grand Prix race was fast. You know, I mean, he finished on the podium. So he's clearly not dropping the ball or failing Ducati in any way. In the end, it could just come down to personality. You know, does Davide Tardozzi and Gigi Aligno think that, you know, Bastianini is a little bit more of a safe pick, you know, if they're prizing Bagnaia? I mean, will he ruffle more feathers against the world champion if he comes into the setup? I mean, these are kind of, I think, the questions Ducati are asking themselves right now. And for Martin, what are your options? You're going to take an Aprilia? You know, he's already kind of skipped out of the Pure Mobility Group options and there's nowhere to go there. And the Japanese situation is still not looking any better. So it's going to be interesting. But of course, we know someone has to move because Fermín Aldeguer, who sort of, you know, showed again once again why he's so highly rated in Moto2 last weekend, is moving up.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a bit of a replica of 2022 when the two boys were constantly throughout the year going for the factory seat. It's obviously, I don't think, going to last as long. I think the decision will be made quite a bit sooner this year. But yeah, what Adam said on Martin is correct. I mean, he's leading the championship. He's already won a sprint this year, won the feature race. But I think Bastianini has shown that he has the potential to be a player in the championship this year. I mean, just looking at his results in Portimao, there's not been anything that special. I think he had a ninth place there in 2021 in his rookie year, which was a good ride then, but he cracked under the pressure in Portimao in 2022, crashed out of the race, obviously had that horrible shoulder injury in last year's sprint. Yet this was a really, really super strong weekend. Finished second somewhat fortuitously, but it would have been interesting if Maverick had stayed on. Bastianini seemed pretty convinced that he could have fought with Maverick on that final lap, crash or no crash. So yeah, it hasn't been an amazing start to the season for Bastianini, but it's been very, very solid, and it's definitely shown that he has kind of refined his zest. He's feeling more settled in the factory garage. And just, yeah, gets on a lot better with the GP24 than he did last year's bike. So, I don't think any of us really expected Bastianini to come out and score victories from the offset. But he's building himself in. He's third in the championship. It's been a really solid start. And noises coming out of Ducati are that they're impressed and they're pleased to see the way he's operating. So, it's a really tough one.
I think most people would assume that people picking riders are going 99% on their ability to bring results. Maybe that 1% is to do with the rider off the track and what else they bring. And Enea is a goofy kid who's kind of likable, but I think aside from results, there's not a great deal to him in terms of marketing or, you know, I don't know, exposure worth, if you like. It could be a factor for Ducati, who knows? But, you know, when he does bring the results, then of course he's a tremendous asset. But, you know, you could argue, isn't it better to have Martin, who's arguably going to be the next great Spanish rider along with Acosta in a couple of years to come? So, it could be another thing, Steve.
Yeah, the commercial realities always come into a decision like that. And for Ducati, their position of strength is they've still got the best bike on the grid. And that's always a good bargaining chip to have whenever you're trying to lower the rate for a rider. But Jorge Martin, at this stage of his career, he wants to be paid. So I can easily see a situation where he could be offered the factory Ducati seat, but it's for a lot less money than Pecco. And he could easily be leading the championship at that stage and saying, no, I want to be paid like a world champion. and then make a decision to leave. And that'll be the interesting part of the summer. But Adam, we've got another Ducati rider to plug in the pod this week, Fabio Di Giantonio, because you sat down for an interview with him as well. Just before we play that, what's your thoughts on Digi?
Digi, I think, you know, is one of these guys that, again, you know, fantastic in terms of knowing his marketing worth. I mean, he was doing stuff with his profile, his social media, some projects the year before last that was different to anybody else. He's really conscious of that side of it and of presenting himself as a professional athlete. You know, his win astounded us all, of course, in Qatar. And I think it'd be interesting for him to try and see if he can nudge Bezzecchi out of the running in terms of being the top dog at VR46. Again, like Neil mentioned earlier with Bagnaia and a sense of mystery, I don't really know what his potential could be. You know, he needs to sort of get his head around that whole new team environment. We ask him a little bit about that in the interview coming up. And I apologize because Digi is a big motocross fan, so it's the first sort of question I asked him just to sort of get the ball rolling. But no, he's a good guy, and I just, you know, I'm curious. I'm sure he's going to get on the podium. Winning races again, you know, it could be one of those, you know, on his particular day, he might do it. But yeah, who knows? Maybe you should ask Neil.
Well, obviously, Neil doesn't want to go into that before we play the interview now for Digi. He's had enough humble pie last year about Digi whenever he really came back to form. So let's hear from Fabio. We're going to take a quick break on the pod, and then when we come back, we'll tie up all the rest of the Portuguese Grand Prix.
Renthal street chain and sprockets are perfectly matched for maximum power transfer and efficiency. From racetrack to daily rider, with over 800 fitments, Renthal Street has a final drive solution for almost any bike. Use renthal.com to find the correct fitment.
Fabio, great to have you on the podcast. Thanks for talking to us. Let's start about the important things first. When was the last time you've been riding motocross?
Well, it's been a while because... during the year I try to don't take so much risks on the bikes, and for sure motocross, I love motocross, but for sure it's more risky sport for us, and that's been, I think, like one month ago, and I miss motocross. I always miss motocross. I would love to do much more motocross than I used to do, but yeah, it's a bit risky, so I have to slow it down a little bit.
Did you speak with Mauro or Gigi asking about the Desmo 450 MX? Is there one coming to your house soon or not?
I didn't speak with them. I want to speak with them. I tried to steal some secrets from Tony. That is my friend, but for sure Tony is super professional and he stays super secret about the bike. But yeah, he showed me a couple of pictures also with Lupino last time we've been doing an enduro together. So yeah, they seem really happy about the bike, seems amazing. And also from an aesthetic point of view, it's super good looking bike. So let's see when will be available also for us. It will be interesting to try.
Yeah, of course, Fabio's talking about Tony Cairoli, and Ducati made their motocross debut recently. I think it was a Mantova?
Yes, Mantova.
Last week, yeah. Let's talk about you here. There was one point last year where I was smiling in your media debriefs because there were especially the Italian journalists saying, you know anything about your contract? It seemed to be a question you had for maybe the better part of 2 or 3 months. And
yeah.
It couldn't have been an easy time for you, and I thought you dealt with it incredibly well. And then, of course, we come to Qatar in the last few races of the season, and your career, you know, moved up a level. How was that six-month period of not knowing what's going to happen, then having the contract, then having the victory, and then coming into this season? It must have been a bit crazy.
Well, yeah. I want to start saying that 2023 has been my best year. The best year of my life, honestly, because it has been a true journey, roller coaster year for sure, with all the emotions that I had. We started with a lot of not expectations, but with a lot of willing to do a good job, and we started not that well. In the middle of part of the season, I was growing, and the results were not coming, but the speed was there, and it was not enough to continue MotoGP. Or at least it was my future at that moment. Seems like this. And then, yeah, it's not been easy. There were a lot of down moments, especially at home, you know, knowing that could be my last season in MotoGP and my last year riding the bike of my dreams. So it was a tough period, but I feel really lucky to have had an incredible people around me, like my collaborators, but also my friends, my family. They helped me a lot, honestly. They always supported me and always they never let me be like really down. They try to give me the power to go ahead, to be focused. And yeah, for sure, at the end of the year, it paid off, because at the end, I was able to improve myself every time I was on the bike. And in the last part of the year, has been just fantastic, because everything turned around, and was just every weekend it was better and better and better. And at the end of the year, was nice also to turn this year that was, could be a bad year into a super opportunity for me to join VR46 team for this season. So yeah, it's been a journey, but I loved it.
Because people have to remember that you didn't come into MotoGP by luck. I mean, you're a multiple Grand Prix winner in different classes. I think people have to realize that you need time to get used to this category. Maybe that's the fault of people like Marquez, Acosta, and even in different sports like a Jet Lawrence or a Jeffrey Herlings, these guys who come in straight away and have instant success. But there are other people who have different stories and different timelines, right?
Let's say that my story is a bit different, let's say. I would love one day to talk about my entire story, let's say. For sure, it's not been easy since I joined Moto2, because I left Moto3 with an eye, because I was runner-up in Moto3. But then in Moto2, I started to struggle a little bit with some other things apart of racing. And I was doing a good job. I was doing podiums, I was winning races, but was a tough every time was a tough period. So I joined MotoGP knowing that I had the potential to do a good job, but you always have to do it then. So it was not easy. And I think last year I had the right people around me also in the garage to make me understand how to use the bike, how to improve, how and where to work and to learn to be a successful MotoGP rider. And let's say that last year my journey in MotoGP and my journey as a true rider, let's say, in MotoGP started. So I want to make it better this year, for sure.
Because there's also some things other people don't see as well, like your professionalism. I mean, I know Alpine Stars really valued the work that you brought to them in terms of development. And then the last interview we did, we were talking about the promotional stuff that you were trying to do with your profile, trying to do something different. You weren't just a guy who sits there thinking, I can't just let my results talk for me, I have to do more around it. So I think that kind of perspective is a big lesson, especially for kids in Red Bull rookies or coming through.
Yeah, well, I always say that I think we have a power to be in my position in front of the cameras with a lot of small fans that are, they're watching us. They try to be like us at the end. So you have a power. You have a true power to inspire people. And I try to be myself. I try to express myself as much as I can. And also, I try to live a good message to the people at home, especially to the young guys, because at the end they are the riders of the future, or the big people of the future. So yeah, I try to do my best, let's say. I try to use this power.
DJ, you come across as an open person, a confident person, but when there are low moments away with injury or you're struggling with the bike setup, competitiveness, how do you kind of work on keeping yourself up?
Well,
I mean, you talk about your group, that must be something, but personally, when you're on the sofa and you're thinking, shit, how do I get out of this hole? How do you do it?
Let's say that I'm learning, and I'm still learning to try to live in the present, really in the present, and enjoy the little things. And it helps me to have all, every day, every moment, small wins. That you bring in your day, So at the end of the day, you see a lot of small wins. So at the end of the day, if it is a bad day, it could be a good day. You can see it in another point of view. So I try to see everything happen in my life. I try to see it in a bad, in a good way, and try to keep all the wins that I got. And this helps me also on the setup of the bike, on the race weekend, maybe. There is a practice that didn't go well as I wanted, but I tried to see all the wins in that practice. So at the end, I come in the garage with a lot of wins instead of a bad session, And this helps me to stay focused, to stay in the present, and try to don't see the result or the future, just work on what I have to do in the next few moments, let's say.
Can you give me an example of a win away from the track? I mean, is that maybe an apartment or a memory or
something?
Yeah.
It's like even in your life, at the end you do breakfast and you was able to do the a good breakfast with maybe one friend, or if you have a girlfriend, your girlfriend, or you're with your family, and it's a great moment that you can do it. You're okay. You are doing the training at home. The training went well, so you are in form. So you can do great things, and you come back home again, and you have a good home, a nice place. It's not about the home itself; it's about a nice place to be safe. So there are, if you see the things with a lot of humble, you see that you have a lot of wins. So you have a lot of wins somewhere to build a good confidence. And from there you start to build this, you know, this little confidence, better and better, and then you bring this to the bike.
Have you always been like that? Or is that just maturity? Because I'm sure when you were 17, 18 years old, maybe you wanted to kick something when the race wasn't going your way, or...
Yeah, well, it's maturing for sure. It's maturing. Is also I have my small circle at home, my small circle that I made from my friends since I was a little kid. And also I am knowing a lot of people, for sure. I'm meeting a lot of new people, and I try to surround myself with a lot of positive minds and inspiring people. It helps me also to mature in a way that I want, let's say, and try. Yeah, it's about the, as I said, about the journey. At the end, you meet people, you get inspired, and you choose which kind of people you can inspire you, and it makes you, well, I try to make a better person every day.
We're talking in the VR46, you know, yes. The Pertamina hospitality. You changed hospitalities. I'm sure everybody's asked you this question, but for the podcast, tell us, moving from, you know, one Italian team where you knew the people, the setup so well, to a new one. How has that been? You know, it took a transition period, but I'm guessing everything is going pretty good, right?
Yeah. Honestly, yes. I'm super surprised. Not that I didn't have any doubts about it, but I'm surprised because, you know, I've been with the Gresini team for 6 years in total. So it was like a long period for me, you know, as a 25 years old guy. And I joined the new team, but I feel like home from the beginning. They treat me so well. Like they treat me like a baby. I want to say that they treat me like a baby, but also they treat me like a top rider. So these two things together, they make me feel comfortable. And also there are a lot of young people with a lot of energy. They want to do this job for passion. So it's nice to stay here. And also the food is really good, honestly.
I was going to say, who does the better hospitality?
Well, it's super bad to say that one is better than other, but for sure in the Civico, we eat quite well. And today also discovered a few new plates, let's say.
You can be diplomatic and say, well, the best pasta is here, but maybe the best tiramisu is there.
Let's say that the Gresini Ospedale was really good, but it was a buffet. And here is fantastic because we have like a menu. So you can choose what you eat, and it's super express. So this is fantastic, and also for the mechanics that they come from a long day working on the bike, they sit with an express plate is fantastic. So I like also this attitude to make everything trying to work as better as possible. So at the moment, I'm super happy with Civico.
We're sitting here with our friend Paul Bertrand, and we're going to have to ask him the truth after this interview and maybe make an edit somewhere. Fabio, when it comes to maybe a slightly awkward question for you, but when it comes to VR46, you were not in it before.
Yep.
And as an Italian guy, did you kind of look at it as maybe some sort of exclusive party that, you know, it would have been where you thought, what's that like inside? You know, how do they work? And but now you are there. What do you think about it?
I'm proud to be part of the team, honestly, because I always give a lot of respect to Valentino himself, to the academy and the team, because whatever they do, it works. It's incredible. And I, from the outside, I was trying to study also a little bit why it was working every time, but you are not involved, you are not inside, so you cannot understand at 100%. And now that I'm in, I understand many, many things.
Is it because they look after the riders? Is it just that simple?
Yeah, is the attitude on everything. Is incredible how much attention and how much
the details
on the details on what is incredible. Is almost crazy in a lot of things, and this is the difference between a good team and a team that wanna win. You know, I always say that this team is a factory team without being factory at the moment. And I hope for this team, honestly, I want to wish for this team to be a factory team, because they deserve to be a factory team. They are incredible. And I think growing with this know-how on your shoulders For a young rider, it helps you a lot, because for a normal rider, let's say, for a no VR46 rider, you have to build your future by yourself with everything, from the trainings, from the attitude at home, from the everything, your stuff. And here you have such a great stuff with a lot of knowledge, a lot of experience, and it's in your hands. You just have to use it. So it's a great support.
Just two more questions. Firstly, you know, over the last few years, there have not been that many riders that have won a MotoGP race for the first time. And now, if I ask you to think back to Qatar, it's only 6 months ago.
Yeah. Too long already.
No, but, you know, you must have had that explosion of happiness when it happened and then the weeks afterwards. But how do you look back on it now? Because some riders, I guess, have the goal of winning championships and cups and medals. And some people just want to be the best on that particular day one time. And you were. So what do you think about it now when you think about LaSalle?
Well, I just see myself there. I admire myself there because I was super focused on just the performance, not the result itself on that moment. I was super, super focused on being better. And also the day before that win, I did second in the sprint behind Martin. I was really upset with that. And it was my best result in MotoGP already. But I was upset because my performance level was not equal as the result, so I was super obsessed about the performance, and I was in a machine mood, let's say. I was a true machine, so I tried to take the good moments from there and bring to this season also, and I see it as a tool that I say, okay, I did it, I know I did it, so let's try to repeat it. I don't want to be the man of that moment, and that's it. I wanna be the man one day. I'm working on myself to try to be the man. So I try to take that moment to bring it inside me, and then try to make in every weekend.
Lastly, I think MotoGP fans before maybe saw you as a good rider, a good guy, a top 10 guy, riding one of the best bikes on the grid. How do you think they see you now, as somebody that's a winner, that can win again, maybe is a bit more of a surprise?
Yeah, well, I hope that I have more people knowing that we have a good potential. I love also to impress people in the other way, let's say, you know, that maybe a lot of people give me already for lost, and I prove them wrong. I like this kind of feeling. Also, I'm quite strange on this. I like to... to do a lot of screenshots on the socials, on everything is bad against me. I like to save everything, and I use it as a wonderful power, because I say, okay, I want to keep these things, and one day when I will be successful, I want to read everything, and I want to laugh on it, you know. So yeah, I like to turn all the enemies into my friends, or into my supporters, and I work also for this a little revenge for me.
Didja, thanks ever so much for joining us. Best of luck.
Thank you.
Welcome back to the Paddock Pass podcast, and a great interview there, Ad, and great to have Digia on the pod. We'll go from something really positive to something a bit negative. Let's talk about Yamaha a little bit, because this was another tough weekend for Yamaha. But during the test, we did see that they brought out quite a lot of innovation to the bike. They're trying new things. They're just trying to see if they can find a solution. Obviously, with the testing restrictions for them, they've got a lot more test days compared to everyone else. Cal Crutchlow's been very busy testing already this year, so they are trying to find a solution. But have you seen anything to give you any sort of shots of optimism for them?
Well, there are definitely reasons to be positive, Steve, but they all seem to be off the bike, off track currently in how they are organizing themselves, how they have added a couple of key personnel to the garage. There hasn't been too much on track at the moment to suggest that they've really found a way to kind of attack the way to make a breakthrough. Seventh place for Fabio in Sunday's race was by no means a disaster, but finishing 20 seconds back of Jorge Martin was, I think, difficult to take for him. This is a track that has been good for Fabio in recent years. You know, he won here in 2021, won here convincingly in 2022 as well. And he seemed a little bit, I mean, he was constantly asked over the weekend about these links to Aprilia that have come up, and he wasn't certainly saying that he is definitely going to stay with Yamaha. He admitted that he is considering his options and that he is looking around elsewhere, and I think he said that it's going to be a pretty difficult decision to make, But you would say that watching Maverick Vinales post the kind of performances that he did during the weekend, Fabio obviously completely outperformed Maverick for two of his years in Yamaha. Well, certainly in 2021 when he won the championship. That is probably quite a tempting offer. It's a difficult one for them. He knows that he doesn't have a great deal of time to make this decision because the longer he waits, maybe Aprilia start looking at other riders or start looking at other candidates for their lead seat. And are Yamaha going to really start showing some massive improvements on track in the next couple of weeks? I don't think so. I think it's more likely to be the second half of the season that we see something from Yamaha coming in. So it's a difficult situation for him.
I think there were some positive signs though, Steve. I mean, Quartararo, when he was talking to us throughout the weekend, was saying his goal was to get into Q2, something that he managed. I mean, Neil's right, you know, he does have good previous form in Portimao, so this was, you know, more of a barometer of where they really are in terms of progress. Fabio said, you know, we have made progress, and the way to work from the Valencia test to now, you know, is a big, big change inside the team. And I think he was quite buoyant about that. Maybe that's too positive a word. But he said, you know, if we've improved by 0.7, he says the problem is everyone's improved by over a second. So you can't really measure the progress that Yamaha have made. I think it's very clear to see in terms of top speed that they've made gains with the M1's engine. But, you know, he said that there's still electronic problems to iron out or real fine tuning to be made. They're in the process. And I think there's this tiny, tiny green shoots there that things could come along, you know, and Quartararo is going to be more competitive than he was last year. I mean, I asked him what was like a bit of a stupid question, and I sort of prefaced it by saying, you know, sorry for the silly inquiry, but you know, the last time he felt great on the Yamaha was 21 when he won the championship, because he had such a strong feeling with the front end of the bike and he could enter corners and make up any kind of deficiencies or disadvantages through that characteristic. And he said, you know, I love that bike, but you know, if you gave it to me now, we'd still be so far off because of the gains of all the others. And again, that's where Yamaha really still need to catch up. They're improving, but not quick enough. But, you know, let's see what happens. You know, the concessions, they were doing extra work. They were testing on the Monday after Portimao, maybe by Jerez and later into the season, Mugello as well. There could be better signs.
Yeah, and they weren't just testing at Jerez for the sake of it. Fabio was saying on the Sunday that they had a host of new items to test. So this hasn't always been the case with Yamaha in the past, where its riders have showed up to a post-race test and not really anything new has been present. They kind of seem to be aware of the situation that they're in now, that they have the concessions they need to take advantage of them this year, because arguably they won't have them to the extent they do at the moment next year. And that's promising. That's definitely promising. But they're still just such a long way off that Fabio, I think, has constantly said that when he's making the decision about next year, he wants to be on a winning bike in 2025. And still, we have to say that the reality is that the Yamaha is nowhere near being a winning bike at present.
Yeah, and I think let's talk with someone doing some winning, because finally, Neil, in your class of choice, Moto2, we got to see Aaron Canet win a race. And I think that this one had to be very popular within the paddock, because I think he's had a podium in one of every 2.5-3 Grand Prix he started in the class. But finally, he gets the win. And luckily, he didn't have the bow tie. So that was all good.
Yeah, interestingly, a few people were messaging me on Twitter saying, ask him about the bow tie, but he actually got rid of the bow tie, I think, at the end of 2022, when he crashed out of the Japanese Grand Prix. He was leading that race, and I think he noticed that it was going to become a bit of a burden, and he told some of the Spanish media, he didn't make it super public, but he told some of the Spanish media that it was a reference to the fact that some Japanese factories had told him they would never hire him for MotoGP because of his tattoos. So the bow tie was kind of an ironic take of him trying to look smart, which I actually thought was quite an intelligent means. I thought it was going to be something silly, like he was a Chippendale in his spare time, or he liked to dance around the pole wearing a policeman's hat. But maybe that would have been better, actually, if he had said that. But yeah, it was good work from Canet. I think he's been threatening this for some time now. He's finished twice, 15 times in Moto2. It was kind of a running joke. He said he changed a few things with his mindset over the off season. He was no longer just thinking about victories. He tried to take some of the pressure off himself a little bit. He's also changed his management. He's now working with Wasserman, Waldmuir. That relationship started, I think, midway through last year. And I think those guys have obviously experience of working with such elite athletes that they're probably able to maybe point them in a bit of a different direction. And he has gelled really well with the Pirelli tires. He did an insane race simulation in Jerez, which was so much faster than everyone else in Moto2. He definitely had the potential to win in Qatar, but we know that that was a bit of a lottery with tire choice, and he made the wrong tire choice. He got somewhat lucky here, I think, because Fermín Aldeguer jumped the start. Aldeguer, I think, definitely had the speed to win that race if he didn't have to do too long lap penalties. Alonso Lopez crashed out of the lead. But that being said, Canet managed his own race very, very well, very intelligently. And you think how much pressure must have been on his shoulders in those last couple of laps. I'm sure there were multiple voices in his head saying, do not fuck this up. Don't fuck this up. And he didn't. And he actually looked the strongest in the closing laps out of anyone in that lead group. So, yeah, fair play to Aaron. I think it's been a long time coming. And you have to say it's deserved.
Credit to him, but do we think the double on lap penalty for Aldeguer's marginal jump start was a bit harsh? I mean, it must be in the rule book, but it does seem a bit of punishing rule, really, for, you know, such a tiny infraction.
It was a lot more harsh whenever it was the ride through penalty as well, which is why we brought in the double long lap penalty. Whether it's for a jump start or going incorrectly into your box, that's the rule we have now. Probably a single long lap penalty would be better. And maybe this will be what instigates a change to a single long lap penalty. But, you know, the alternative was what the old rule was. And this isn't that bad.
I think he was maybe punished by the fact that the long lap penalty in Portimao is it seems longer than some of the other ones. I need to go back and check the times, but it certainly gave the impression that it was more than just like adding on 2 or 3 seconds. It was quite lengthy. But Aldeguer's fight back from 13th, I think it was incredible. I mean, there were times in that where it did seem a bit Marquez-esque, his kind of his progress up to the front. So, you know, signs are good for Fermín. And he was able to kind of to get that bad feeling from the first weekend certainly off his shoulders.
Another newsworthy thing from the Moto2 results, Steve, is, you know, Joe Roberts taking his first podium finish, you know, for the American racing team again, of course, sort of backed by OnlyFans this year. And that was very timely, of course, right before Cota and his home race. But then also there was some increased chat that, you know, he's going to be the main pick for Trackhouse in 2025. And, you know, it's a move that makes sense, of course, an American team having, you know, the top American rider. I mean, Neil and I were talking about this during the sort of the weekend. It's, you know, the onus is firmly on Roberts to really show that he has the potential to, you know, do something in MotoGP. You know, riders have come in and they've had opportunities, you know, sort of rightly or wrongly or deservedly or not. I mean, Darren Binder, for example, you know, jumping straight out of Moto3 into MotoGP, he didn't disgrace himself. I mean, he had a top 10 finish and he was on a really steep learning curve. And, you know, Roberts could be in a similar position. I tried to sort of ask him in the press conference if he'd had any sort of contact with Trackhouse, but sort of fudged the question slightly. And he said that he had been to the team launch and we saw him there purely by virtue of the fact that he lives 10 minutes away from where Trackhouse did the event in downtown LA. Well, not downtown, but more sort of in Hollywood, in that region. And he said, you know, he's open to the move. He said, sure. His words were something like, sure, why not? But, you know, maybe that could spell the end for Raul Fernandez, certainly in Aprilia colours, because where else does he go?
Well, it's one of those situations that even when we had Justin Martin on the pod, when the whole team was announced and their structure, we all talked about the fact that there is an inevitability that they will be linked to an American rider. And the team have always said, it's not a guarantee. You need to be competitive. So right from that moment, one of the things we've all talked about is the fact that Roberts will get a chance if he's competitive. But to be competitive, that means the first 6 rounds of this year, he has to be on the podium, he has to be consistent, he has to win. And then you could get that opportunity. And this is a good starting point for that. I think that, you know, Joe, if he's offered MotoGP again, he's not going to turn it down. He's already done that once and lived to regret it. So I can't see him doing that again a second time. Neil, just to look at Moto2 as well, we saw Danny Helgado win. So he's gone 2-1 for his first two rounds of the year. And the class, again, this year, you'd expect that as the year progresses, we'll have those 5-6 guys that are going to be at the front all the way through. But what did you make of the Moto2 weekend, Moto3 weekend?
It was a good race. Another blisteringly fast race compared to last year. Helgado sort of managed to right the wrongs from the previous week in Qatar, where he was mugged essentially at the last corner by David Alonso after leading, I think, every lap of the race bar two. This time he managed to defend really well, really ably from Jose Antonio Rueda, and did a good job. And he actually broke a bone in his left wrist during preseason, which he managed to keep pretty quiet. Didn't really make a big deal of it, which I have to admire. And also, he left the San Marino GP with 8 races to go leading the championship. He ended up finishing 5th overall. So you could say that he really did kind of bottle it and fall apart. But I think last year was just a year too soon, and now he seems a bit more of a proper championship contender. So yeah, I think Helgado looked great. But I do think there are 4 other guys in Moto3 this year that are going to be pushing them all the way. So I think we're going to see a bit of variety between that quintet of Ortola, Rueda, Helgado, Alonso, and Vire. It should be a good one. And yeah, Helgado is definitely going to be one of the names up at the front.
Yeah, 25 points from this weekend. And this is also the 25th year of Fly Racing. And I think a lot of people always just associate Fly with off-road and specifically motocross and supercross competition. But they actually have a great range of on-road street wear as well. So if you're looking for any new gear, it's definitely worth checking out flyracing.com for gloves, jackets, trousers, anything at all. So check them out as well. We've got a couple of questions in from some of our patrons as well. Jeremy Burnage just asking whether or not Maverick is the human form of Aprilia. So I'll give that one to you, Neil.
I think it's a very salient point. And it's a good comparison. They do seem made for each other, because just when either the bike or the rider seems to be in a position of tremendous promise, they almost find a way to not get the result. That makes you think, is Maverick really what that factory needs? Because when the bike is good, the rider finds a way not to do things in a good way. When the rider is good, the bike finds a way to deprive the rider of a result. So it's a bit of a tough situation. There is a kind of remarkable likeness and unpredictability about both factory and rider.
And we had a question in from DJ Purchase as well, and he was asking about Marquez in Coda. I presume this is about Mark and the approach that he'll take riding the Ducati. Will he ride it like a Ducati needs to be written, or will he ride it like Coda needs to be written?
Well, that's the big thing, isn't it? That's the million-dollar question for Marquez and his whole potential at the moment with the bike that he's on. It's a great track for him. It's something he's been talking about, how he that last kind of percentage that he needs for the success is still like in Honda mode. Just to sort of paraphrase some of the comments he's been making to us. And I don't really know. I mean, Qatar is one of the longest tracks on the calendar, one of the most technical in terms of stringing together some of the windy sections as well as the long straight. I mean, he's going to be happy to have that sort of Ducati power, Steve. But whether he can really put it again into a race-winning situation, it might still be a little bit too early. We were talking about this on the pod, I think, last time, and we were saying, you know, what kind of race does Mark really get into a position where he's going to win? I think he's going to be extremely competitive in the US, but I still wouldn't say he's right there with it yet. I would try and squeeze him into my fantasy team for that Grand Prix, but I would also not say yet I'm putting all my money on him for it to win it again.
Yeah, an excellent segue for us into our fantasy league as well. Obviously this year it's been presented by Alpine Stars, and we have to give them a big thanks for supporting us in that way. The important thing is to not miss out on your chance to purchase the new Supertech R10 helmet. And Adam, I know you're a big fan of action movies, and if that helmet's good enough for John Wick, it's good enough for pretty much anyone. Always a cool film and a guy that's willing to take a headshot or two. So if the Supertech R10 is able to protect that noggin, it's good enough for mine as well. just when we look at our fantasy, we've all got some catching up to do because Dane's helmet is miles in front of us. We have to. We've got almost 1,000 players on the league right now. And Dane's helmet has destroyed my initial scores. But I think a lot of that, Neil, went down to the fact that you destroyed my chances of round one. So I'm now suddenly playing catch up and changing half my team around to make sure that I'm able to get Mark on my team for Coda. Coincidentally, I've actually dropped Pecco to do that ad. And I've been lumbered with Trackhouse at the start of the season, so I've now switched them out as well. So that's my two transfers done for the next round already sorted. But Neil, like, I know you explained yourself to everyone. You have apologized to me. You're a disgraceful excuse for a friend to have done something like that on round one. I expect it at the end of the season, not this early in the year.
Yeah, I would call you a disgraceful excuse for a friend as well. But then it was you that gave me your login for the World Superbike website, which caused this kerfuffle. Yeah, I'm sitting really pretty at the moment in 831st position. So I think it's safe to say that already I'm not going to be challenging for the top honours in the league this year, which is a pretty grim feeling, I must say. After just two rounds, I can't believe I was talking about myself as if I was some kind of MotoGP fantasy oracle during the off season, and here I am disgraced after such an early pitfall. But there you go, that's life.
I would say one thing, Neil, that actually if you had had my points from round one, you'd still be behind me, so that's okay. Adam, how are you getting on so far?
Well, my situation, Steve, in my team, I have Brad Binder and Pecco Bagnaia as gold riders, and I have Pedro Acosta as silver rider, and I put Quartararo in for Portugal because I thought, okay, you know, he was looking pretty good and, you know, he stood a chance of qualifying well, but of course didn't work out so well thanks to the racing incident, as we want to call it. I'm solidly mid-table, and I would take that position for Queen's Park Rangers as well at the moment. So, you know, I'm just hoping some of my progress with that is. But yeah, Steve, I have a question for you, because Dane's helmet, that's the team name that's currently leading things, is from American. But if you look, there's a player called Speed Freak in second, and then Gordon Ritchie, 73, in third place.
There's no way Gordon Ritchie was born in 1973, so that's clearly a different Gordon Ritchie.
It might be his preferred number, but that can't be Gordo, surely, because it was made in Australia.
Definitely not Gordo.
Also, his pseudonym is Speed Freak, is it not?
It certainly is, yeah.
Maybe they're the same person.
I would say one thing about fantasy before we move on to winners and losers. Adam, you're solidly mid-table, so happy for QPR with that. And just like QPR against Ipswich, I'm solidly ahead of you. So I'm happy with that through two rounds. But let's move it on to the end of the show, really. And Adam, give me your winner from the Portuguese Grand Prix.
This is a spontaneous one, Steve, because we haven't had a chance to prepare these. So winners.
Yes, we have. We always do these.
Yeah, but we did. We weren't going to do it on this show, but we decided to do it last minute. Okay, who do I pick as a winner? Let me think. Seeing as we haven't talked about it all that much, I will say, Neil did mention Daniel Horgado, so I can't pick him. I'll just say Enea Bastianini, because, you know, especially after what happened to him in last year in Portimao, to get back on the podium, that's, you know, a pretty good reversal fortune.
Neil, what about you?
I'll go with Joanne Mir. Steve, we haven't spoken about Joanne. It doesn't sound like 11th place was much to holler about.
Yeah, how's that a win?
Have you seen the predicament Honda's in?
I don't know what you mean. The last four bikes on the grid? Solid.
Exactly. Yeah, it was a horrible weekend for Honda. Mir was pushed off track, I think, early on the first lap by Franco Morbidelli. Had a big black mark down his leathers and on his bike from the impact, but actually managed to fight back from 21st on the first lap to finish in 11th. And yes, he got a bit lucky with some people crashing ahead of him, but I think it was a pretty good job. And the other Honda riders were all complimenting Mir on the race that he did and the way that he's riding the Honda at the moment. I think he had such a dreadful year last year. There was a danger of him maybe just fading away completely, but I think he is showing signs that he's rising to become the leader of Honda as he needs to be. It looks as though it's worked, the switch in the side of the garage, working now with Santi Hernandez, Marquez's old crew. And just the way he's talking, there's a bit more of a sparkle in the eye compared to just the very depressed, solemn figure that we saw last year. So yeah, Mir, I think, doesn't look like much, but I think there are signs that we're seeing the best of John Mir again, and that he's the guy that's leading Honda, and he's doing a pretty good job at the moment, I think.
Steve, it warms my heart that Neil's picking winners in our podcast because of the sparkle in their eye. I mean, if I walk into the press room with, you know, an extra kick in my step, I hope that Neil's going to be thinking I'm deserving of a winner mantle.
Yeah, everyone always notices you, Ad, when you walk into the media center, so that's okay. I'll pick Mr. Bowtie as my winner from the weekend. How could it be anyone else on the weekend when Aaron Canna finally gets that first Moto2 win? Although I would say that I was also thinking of Fermín Aldeguer, just because what he did in the qualifying session, even with the penalties, how he rode in Sunday's race, and then also the fact that he's one of the guys that's now got his future sorted. So, Neil, for your big loser from the weekend, who are you picking?
Well, just briefly, Pekka Bagnaia, because of what we've mentioned, that he comes away from round two with a big zero, just like he did from round two last year. He was nowhere near the performance that we expected from him through free practice, where it looked as though it was going to be another really strong weekend. It didn't quite come to pass. And it seems that he's already had a bit of a, well, he has already had a bit of a run-in with Marc Márquez, and Marc Márquez, the one person that he doesn't want to beat him, was on the cusp of beating him, had it not been for that crash. So yeah, I think, he's definitely had better weekends.
Adam, what about you?
I think it's a bit of a tie between Franco Morbidelli and Luca Marini, but, you know, we don't want to be picking those guys every week.
At least Franco crashed.
Yes, yes. I mean, you know, it's a pretty desperate situation for him. I mean, the ultimate catch-up scenario with Franco. And the thing is, he's under pressure to grab some results, really. I mean, you'd have to say that, you know, based on everything that's happened to him over the last 2.5 years, he really is the rider looking most in danger of slipping out of MotoGP for 2025. But he's a cool guy, and, you know, he's still an extremely fast rider. So I, you know, fingers crossed he can turn things around.
In his defense, he did actually have a couple of decent sessions, and his pace at the end of the race after he rejoined was good enough for top 8, which I think, all things considered, that he missed preseason is not bad. So I think there are signs that Franco is coming to terms with the Ducati and making up for lost time.
Good shout, Neil. I had to pick someone.
And for me, the reason that I had said at least Franco crashed is he only finished 10 seconds behind Marini. And we already saw what happened in Qatar for Marini of, oh, I wanted to have a closer look at some of the other bikes. Well, he's 40 seconds down. He's 2 seconds a lap off the pace. He's 2 seconds a lap off in qualifying as well. So for me, very easy to go with Luca as my big loser. And, you know, we're 2 rounds into his decision to leave a Ducati and go to Honda. Fair enough, he's going to earn a lot of money over these 2 years compared to what he would have earned being a satellite Ducati rider. But the mental beating he's taken at the minute must be significant. So for Luca, he needs something that's going to give him light at the end of the tunnel. But right now, it's that train coming at him rather than any sense of getting out of the darkness. So I'm going with Luca Marini as my big loser from the weekend. But obviously enough, guys, there's no losers that support us on Patreon. So patreon.com/podcast. On Patreon, you get a lot of early access to our podcast and an awful lot of additional content. Adam, you'd put up quite a few interviews over the course of the last couple of weeks just for our Patreon supporters. They gradually get fed into the podcast, but there is a lot of Patreon-only content as well, such as our Paddock Notes show during the course of race weekends as well. So check out patreon.com/paddockpasspodcast. On that, at the minute, we've got early access to our Catalunya round of World SBK review, where myself, Gordo, and Evo chat about what we saw in round two of World SBK as well. So check out Patreon to be able to become a supporter on that as well. We'll obviously be back to preview the Grand Prix of the Americas, but that'll be in a couple of weeks' time. So next week, we're going to try and get together for another show as well. And we've got a few interviews in that. Ad, I know you sat down with Chaz Davis to talk Moto E. So what's Chaz got to say to give people a little bit of a teaser?
Not just Moto E, Steve. I mean, he talked about the transition from being like a full-time, you know, superbike racer into sort of being a rider coach. Some of the development work he did with Ducati for Moto E. Also, you know, his thoughts on Grand Prix racing now, and of course, Casey Stoner, you know, who he sort of learned a lot from and is good friends with. So, yeah, I mean, it's a long interview. It's really interesting. And Chaz is incredibly articulate and sort of a really smart guy. So I'm hoping it'll be something that people want to listen to next week.
Yeah, I'm sure they will. And thanks for joining us on the pod as ever, Ad. And the same to you as well, Neil. And for all of us on the Paddock Pass podcast, big thank you to Renthal Street, to KTM and to Fly Racing for supporting the podcast.
This episode of the Paddock Pass podcast was produced by David Emmett, Steve English, Neil Morrison, and Adam Wheeler. Music is provided by The Libertines. All inquiries can be sent via email to team@paddockpasspodcast.com.